Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. I wanted to just share some really, really great, exciting news with you. You're listening to Bhavani on the Progressive Radio Network, and I am here to share with you the wonderful news that yesterday Governor Cuomo has banned fracking from New York State. And that is a big, big, wonderful, amazing thing, and I am just so glad to have been a part of it. Thank you to New Yorkers Against Fracking. Thank you to Food and Water Watch, and thank you to all of you volunteers who came out and showed your support. And it just shows how when we work together and put our voices together, we actually can make change. And Governor Cuomo listened to the experts. He said he was not involved in this decision. He put it out to the experts and listened to their advice. Unlike so many who put it out to the experts and then disregard the advice and move forward with the agenda that just profits the corporations and does not take into consideration the actual health of the people and the planet. So thank you so much to Governor Cuomo and to all of the organizations that participated. I also want to let you know that most of today's show I pre-recorded to accommodate my guest, but I wanted to come on and just let you all know and wish you all a wonderful, happy holiday. Both Christmas and New Year's this year falls on Thursday, so I will be back with you on January 8th. So have a great rest of the day. Enjoy the show, and I'll see you all on January 8th. Of course, I'm going to start off by sharing my weekly recipe with you, but my guest today is Callie Curry, also known as a street artist, Swoon, and I love her work. I met her at the Brooklyn Museum this year when she had her solo show there, and I'm really thrilled to have her on and share with us the work that she's doing and how she's connecting so many of our global issues with her work. So she'll be on in a little while. But first, as always, I want to talk about some of the things going on in and around the city, ways that you can get involved, and things you all need to be aware of. First, I just want to share with you that this week my blood was boiling when I read about the final spending bill that just was approved through Congress, which curtailed the new regulations that were going to be put on to the school lunch programs. And this final spending bill, I mean, it just has me furious. We've already gone through the school nutrition program and have already, come to agreement that we need to improve the school lunch program. It's not rocket science. And here they are saying that the government does not have the right to curtail the amount of salt that is in the school lunch program, nor require the schools to transition to whole grain pastas and breads and tortillas and things like that. I mean, there was not a lot of change in the school lunch program to make it better to start with. We're trying to get more fruits and vegetables into our kids and less salty foods, less fatty foods. They actually had the nerve in this New York Times article to say that more testing has to be done to prove that the government needs more research to prove that these changes would benefit the kids before requiring costly changes to the school lunch program. And, you know, New York Times a couple months ago had this great article, actually it was a whole New York Times magazine, all about children and the way they eat and the school lunch program, and it demonstrated that the lobbying that was going on behind closed doors and probably right out on the floor, the lobbying being done by the conglomerate food companies and the pizza manufacturer was the main lobby. I mean, this pizza manufacturer, I don't recall his name, or the company's name, they were going to lose billions of dollars because they're cutting the pizza out of the school lunch program, rather than the pizza company having to make healthier pizza, figuring out a way to reduce the fat, use whole grains in the crust. But it just infuriates me. And then another provision in this spending bill was that the government cannot regulate the national, cannot regulate the waste coming out of are factory farms. Again, it is a fact that most methane that is being released into our environment that is affecting global greenhouse gas emissions, that methane needs to be regulated. And that was something that the Clean Water Act, people were trying to push through, and that, too, has been turned backwards. And they are saying that we don't have the right to regulate. You know, this was a big victory for the National Cattlemen and Beef Association, who did huge lobbying to get this into the final spending bill. But it is a fact that greenhouse gas emissions from factory farms is the largest cause of methane gas, which affects our global environment. And we just need to get on board. And they need to hear from all of us. Because if they don't, if we all are silent as they push these things through, it's just going to keep going on and going on. It just makes me so angry. As someone who has worked in the school lunch program, who has spent so many years trying to push towards healthier school lunch, and Michelle Obama, who's worked so hard to try to get some of these things pushed through, to see it turned around in, you know, one moment is just infuriating. So check out that article that came out in what, this was in Monday's paper, but, you know, there's stuff, you know, going to be in the news all week long about it. So look into that and take a stand wherever you see an opportunity. A couple things going on. This coming Friday, actually, I will have the opportunity to be interviewed for the Stony Brook radio show, WUSB, at 6 o'clock with Beth Fettini. So if you are around, that would be great. I am starting to gear up for Feeding the Homeless again for my large annual Christmas event. This is our 20th year partnering with the River Fund Food Pantry in cooking for the homeless. And we typically feed 600 people outdoors at Rufus King Park and then send another bunch of food to some homeless shelters for another 400 people. So we're cooking for about 1,000 people. And it's a wonderful community event. This year, because Thanksgiving was so late, I feel like I just got through some Thanksgiving, and here it is Christmas. So I'm barely coming up for air, but I'm really excited to be out there in the park again with these wonderful people. And we also do Christmas caroling as part of that. So if you want to volunteer, please send me an email at bhavani@iegreen, and I'd be happy to add you to the schedule. And if you have a good voice, please come down to Rufus King Park at 11 o'clock on Tuesday, the 23rd. That's the day we serve, and join our Christmas caroling. January 7th, there are buses being organized throughout the state to go up to Albany to the State of the State address at the state capitol. And Governor Cuomo has to decide whether he's going to allow fracking in New York State. And we want to make sure that his decision is a big no. So we need everybody on board for that. So if you can make the time on January 7th, either drive up yourself or join a bus. I know there's buses from Long Island, from Syracuse, from all around the state. They're being organized by New Yorkers Against Fracking and Food and Water Watch. So you can go to either of those websites to find out more information. The Massachusetts NOFA Winter Conference is coming up. That is January 10th at Worcester State College. And the New York NOFA Winter Conference is coming up. That's January 23rd to the 25th at the Saratoga Hilton in Saratoga Springs. These events are always great opportunities to meet with farmers, listen to lectures, participate in workshops, and just be involved in your local food movement. So it's great if you can do that. January 21st and 22nd, I will be heading down to the first annual Food Tank Summit in Washington, D.C., and I am hoping to actually record my show live from the Food Tank Summit in Washington, D.C. on January 22nd. So I hope you will be able to join that. The recipe this week is vegan, gluten-free potato latkes, and that's in celebration of Hanukkah, which just started last night, actually Tuesday night. So I want to share that with you. And these latkes are really very flexible. I mean, I am going to be giving you this recipe just with potatoes and carrots in it. But you can also add sweet potatoes. You can add parsnips, any hard root vegetable that you can grate. You can add into these latkes, and they're really delicious. Traditionally, they are fried, but I have also experimented with baking them, and that works as well. If you bake them in a very hot oven on greased parchment paper, they will come out crispy as well. So the things you need, 3/4 cups of bisan flour, which is also chickpea flour, or you can use another gluten-free type flour that you like. But I really love the flavor of the chickpea flour. A quarter teaspoon of baking soda, 1/2 cup of cold water, 1 large onion cut into slivers, 2 potatoes grated with the water squeezed out, 2 carrots grated, 1/4 cup of fresh chopped parsley, and that's optional too, 1 teaspoon salt, and then oil for frying. Now, when you buy oil, if you buy organic, of course, that's the best. But if you're not going to buy organic oil, you want to make sure that the oil is GMO-free, because most vegetable oil is made from corn, which you know is GMO'd, soybeans, which is GMO'd, and cotton, which is GMO'd. So most vegetable oil, unless it says GMO-free or you're buying organic, is very high in genetically modified ingredients. So do try to do that. So you're going to start in a large bowl. You're going to make a batter with the chickpea flour, the baking soda, and the water. Then you're going to add the rest of the ingredients and mix that up well. And you're going to drop by spoonfuls into the deep fryer or a frying pan filled with oil. The trick with my potato latkes is you don't want to form these latkes into hard balls or press them down at all. You really want the pieces of onion and carrot to be, you know, spreading out in all directions so that you have more crispy edges in your potato latkes. And they're just great. And you can serve them with applesauce, or you can make a tamarind chutney or a mango chutney or whatever you'd like to serve with it. Traditionally, latkes are served with applesauce and or sour cream. But being that these are vegan ones, I wouldn't recommend the sour cream. And that is it. And I hope you all enjoy them, because they are really delicious and it's, you know, just traditional this time of year with the holiday of Hanukkah. Now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest on, Callie Curry, who goes by the name as Swoon for her art installations and street art, was classically trained in New York at Pratt, and has spent the last 13 years exploring the relationship between people and their environment. And she constructed some floating sculptural rafts that she took down the Mississippi River and Hudson Rivers and across the Adriatic Sea to Venice. And I'll let her tell us more about that and all the work that she's doing incorporating her passion for the environment with her artwork. Callie, are you with me?
Hi, how are you?
Hi, great. How are you?
Good. Can you hear me okay?
Perfectly.
Great.
So I wanted to just start by asking you to share with us what inspired you to go from your classical training of painting to making street art. Was this like a gradual process, or did you just wake up one day and say, you know, I'm out of the studio, I want to do this out on the street?
It was a little bit sudden in a way. I had been painting since I was a kid, and I just had a little bit of a nervous breakdown around it when I got into my 20s, and I started to feel, I was in art school, and I felt that there was kind of a cattle chute that was heading me from art school to sort of the production of objects in the kind of ceaseless capitalist production of objects sense of art objects for the kind of, you know, commodity market of the art market, which, granted, is something that I survived some, so I can't knock it entirely, but I just had this feeling that that could never, ever, ever be the whole entire story. And so I just was like, this can't be my life. There has to be more to this. And I felt this kind of breakdown around the idea of just making an object, and that being it. And so I started to kind of search for other ways for the things that I made to have different meanings and to become part of the context of my life in different ways. And so my first answer to that was to look to the city itself, because I was not from a city originally. I was so blown away by the culture and the architecture and everything that was happening in New York, and I just felt like I wanted to physically be a part of that. And so that's how I started working outside.
Uh-huh. And where are you originally from?
I'm from Florida originally, but I was looking at a lot of different traditions, and one of them was the Mexican muralists, who really had this philosophy about creating things which were public and which belonged to everyone. So that was kind of one of the original impetuses in that.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that many of your pieces are inspired by what's going on in the world. You know, an environmental disaster and climate change, I know, has affected a lot of your work, both, you know, the earthquake in Haiti and the hurricane in Katrina. Can you share with us some of the artwork that you made that revolved around that, like the Comb Beat project, mm-hmm. The Comb Beat shelter project, and also what you did in Katrina?
Yeah. Well, the project that I have created that's been the most direct response to a catastrophe has been Comb Beat Shelter, which is a rebuilding project that I started with some friends after the earthquake. And it was just this moment where we kind of realized we had been doing such large scale, really unlikely endeavors together, and that we were incredibly ready to be problem solvers and to think creatively about issues. And that, you know, I just kept asking myself, like, what would happen if we took this skill set and we applied it to a time of crisis? And so when the earthquake hit in Haiti, it was something that we had been thinking about for long enough that we felt ready. And so we approached a small community to see if they wanted to work with us around a rebuilding project. And it's ongoing to this day, actually, where the work changes a little bit every year in kind of response to the collaborative nature of working with, you know, one small group of artists and a small village. And, we just have been carrying it on since. So far, we built one community center and two homes, and then we've been doing some educational programming in the community center. And next, we're going to be working on further adapting the building styles to try to figure out, you know, what are some sustainable building styles that will work in the conditions of Haiti, because the situation that people were working with was trying to use really expensive imported building materials, unsustainable building materials, to build in a way that was ultimately way too vulnerable.
Uh-huh. Well, so, I love the little huts that you created. They look like little hobbit shelters to
they're
me.
They look like huts, I guess, in the pictures, but the ceilings have to be 20 feet tall. The way that we've designed them, the original engineer that did the engineering is a man named Nader Khalili, and he designed this building so that it has to have really tall ceilings if it's going to be in fitting with the geometry of this incredibly resilient style. And so they're actually kind of massive. People always call them huts, and I want to be like, no, no, they're like kind of the mansions in the neighborhood.
Really? Okay. You're right, because in the picture, they remind me of little hobbit, you know, like you'd have little people coming out of there.
Oh, no, they're huge.
Uh-huh. They also reminded me a little bit of a Gaudi influence. You know, like when I went to Barcelona once and went through the Gaudi Park, you know, they had all these little, or just built into the landscape, rounded homes.
Curves, right? It's so beautiful.
They are beautiful. And so, as of right now, the pictures that I saw online, that was of the community center?
Probably, and there's two homes in a community center. So you could have been seeing pictures of all three of those things.
Uh-huh. And you said it's continuing now, they're adding more of those, or is it going in a different direction?
We're continuing working with them. So we're thinking, we built, each one was adapted a little bit in response to community feedback, and this time we're going to keep going and think about some of the farmers that we're working with have been growing bamboo, and so we would like to do some workshops with the kids and adults around architecture and engineering and start to just really get into some creative thinking about how bamboo could also be incorporated into the into the next architectural ideas.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I love them. That's great. Now, were you able to get funding? Did you work independently with the one village in Haiti, or did you have to go through the government to do that?
I ended up working independently, and that's the thing that me as an artist, a lot of the funding for my projects comes from the sale of artwork. And so we pretty much did all of our fundraising independently and with collaborators like Creative Time in New York connected us with a Rockefeller Foundation grant for one of the houses. And, you know, Upper Playground in San Francisco sold a print for me. Like, there's all different people who have kind of jumped in to help with the funding. And in that way, actually, we didn't have to work through any of the bureaucratic channels. And what that meant is that we were able to be on the ground building pretty much immediately. And we had a structure finished within 6 months, which people were, like, totally shocked about. They were like, you know, this is unheard of. Like, most, you know, big projects are kind of stuck still with their materials and customs, and you guys are already, like, you know, finishing the plaster on a structure. But that was because we had that kind of just human-to-human scale thing going on, and we were able to just get started immediately.
Uh-huh. Beautiful. Can you share with us what the swimming cities of, how do you say it, Serenissima?
Yeah.
Should I say it right?
Yeah, so that project, it actually started a few years prior to that with some friends and I. We created a series of rafts, like a flotilla of rafts that we took down the Mississippi River. And, you know, it's one of those things where we were artists with a lot of thinking about ecological problems. And I think in the end, our strength really ended up to be the creativity more than any kind of ecological solution finding. But it still was really fun to see how small of a footprint we could create or take up, how little garbage we could produce, how much we could, you know, we just sort of changed up our living systems as we were living on these rafts and traveling down the river. And, you know, we were just sort of trying to figure out different systems that we could create that would just, you know, give us a different relationship to nature and also give us a different relationship to the systems that support our lives. And so we built these rafts ourselves and we traveled with them and we did all kinds of performances and connecting with different people in the towns along the way, along the river. And then from there, that had been an extremely collective project, and I knew that I wanted to keep going with boats, but I had a lot of more sculptural visions that were kind of still in my head. And so I started with swimming cities. And, you know, speaking of climate change, the rafts originally for me had a lot to do with, you know, so much of my work has to do with processing the emotions and the anxieties around the moment that we're in right now. And so, you know, so much of thinking about climate change and rising seas and dislocation and the kind of vulnerable communities built at the edges of different ecosystems and, you know, self-built communities and how vulnerable those communities, the poorer communities of people who are self-organizing are going to be the most vulnerable to the climate change as, you know, as we start to see, like, the typhoons that just went through the Philippines and so on. And so I just had a lot of these images in my mind, and as I was building these, what to me were like little miniature kind of floating cities that felt like pieces of edge cities sort of broken off in the floods and kind of floating out to sea. And so there was a lot of joy and wonder to the project, but my kind of seed image for the rafts had a lot to do with kind of feeling my own and our collective anxiety about the ecological moment that we're in right now.
Right. And most of the raft was all reclaimed materials, right? It was all stuff that otherwise would have been in a landfill.
Exactly. So we would go around to, for example, construction sites in New York City and be like, hey, what's that pile of plywood and what are you doing with it? And they'd be like, oh, that's our cement forming boards. We're throwing them away. And so, you know, first we would take them, you know, five at a time. Can we take five? Can we take, you know, however many we can fit? And then eventually one of the guys at one of the sites started forklifting it into the truck, into the back of the truck. But that here is less dumpster. You know, they were happy to not have to buy an extra dumpster for that. And, you know, and then we would also just drive around and collect stuff. So it was also, you know, that sort of initial impulse of being like, how do we not chop down brand new resources? How do we reuse what's already at our disposal to create this kind of physical object?
Right, right. Which, you know, everybody needs to start thinking like that. You know, reclaiming materials is so important. And if you look at other cultures, that's always been done. I mean, you know, even, you know, how we use garbage bags. I mean, you know, the Europeans, you go over there, and they don't get a garbage bag every time they, or a supermarket bag every time they go out. They keep reusing the things over and over. And, you know, even simple wrapping paper. I mean, everybody should think about it this time of year where people are become, you know, get sucked up into that consumerism and they're buying all this stuff and then wrapping all this stuff and just throwing it out. How can you use reclaimed newspaper or paper or plastic, whatever, to wrap your gifts in a more creative way?
Beautiful that stuff can be. I was just thinking of some ropes that a friend of mine gave me. They were made out of torn old saris, and then they wove them into ropes, and they were so gorgeous. And just the amount of craft that goes into that, you feel it, you know?
Right, right, and it is nice. So I saw your most recent show at, I don't know if it's your most recent, but the one that you just had at the Brooklyn Museum that was just phenomenal where I met you. And I hope many of my listeners got to catch that show. But in that show, you had some of the rafts. Were those the rafts that you actually sailed with?
Yeah, those were the rafts. We brought them back, and they were built modularly, so we were able to just bring them through the elevator and just take them apart and put them back together. And actually now they are taking their final home in the forest upstate. At some friends of mine are starting a retreat center for different activist organizing groups to be able to have some space to organize themselves outside of the city and take breaks and connect with each other. And they've ended up hosting the rafts for their final kind of treehouse home.
Ah, great. Great. That's a nice place for it to be. And how perfect the setting, you know, for a retreat center for organizations that are doing good work.
Right. No, it's awesome. Yeah, it's really exciting.
Perfect. So another thing that was really attracted me to your work is how you work collaboratively. I'm sure you heard at the beginning of my show I was talking about how, you know, I work together with people in the community just to cook food for people that are hungry. And as much, very often, I, you know, it's so much work. Sometimes I think about not wanting to do it. This is my 20th year this year. And it's so much work, but the one of the highlights of it for me is meeting people I don't even know, and people I had over 80 people coming through my kitchen a few weekends ago for Thanksgiving, just helping to cook, and it becomes a community, you know, event and bringing people together that don't know each other and all the collaboration that happens to make something happen when working together is a high all by itself.
Totally. And joy of working together. That, like, group work is a thing that we really miss in our culture, and it's such a joyful experience when it happens.
Right, like the barn raisings. And
And it feels, I think there's, like, something, it's, like, part of our consciousness to really want that, to crave that.
I think you're right. And so in your installation at the Brooklyn Museum, that was huge. Did you have other people helping you to make that happen?
Oh, yeah, we had a really, really big team. And so the thing about the Brooklyn Museum installation, and I was just thinking about this today, is that, you know, on the one hand, you know, you see that, and I did design it, and it was my work, and it was sort of, it just had my name on it, but we also had this list on the wall that talked about, you know, it named everyone who had been involved in it, because it's just not really accurate to say this is one person's work, because there's absolutely no way that I could have solved all those problems, that I could have created all that stuff, you know. And even like on the boats, there were some really serious aspects of creative collaboration that went into that, and so I really wanted to make sure and honor that. And you know, the work of, you know, we probably had like 75 people over the course of the project who really lent their hands and minds to it. You know, and then that's also not to mention the boats. You know, there was everyone that got together to build them. There were people, you know, everyone who designed the steering systems and the driving systems and the motors and all of these things that are just not even part of my imagination. You know, people who came together to create those things and to figure out, you know, how do you build things like this? You know, I really wanted to honor this experience of the Mapo tree in Haiti and to bring that kind of like massive, beautiful, like awe-inspiring grandeur into that huge space in the rotunda, but I have no clue how to do that without killing people, you know? And so really Sameer, who's worked on all kinds of boat projects and who just has a kind of imagination that's really out of bounds and really just, like, dreams up kind of how to make things work. And so, you know, without people like that, there's no way it would happen. And, yeah, and just the feeling of executing it together is so super awesome.
Yeah, and you can feel it. I mean, you feel that when you went into the space. It was very powerful. It was beautiful. Another piece that you had there that I absolutely loved was, it felt like an igloo type of thing with the mother and child figurines above it. Can you share some of the inspiration behind that piece?
Yeah. Well, so if you don't mind, I'll back up and tell the entire sort of the explanation of the title. Does that make sense?
Sure, absolutely. Submerged Motherlands, right?
Yeah. Submerged Motherlands. And the reason that it's called that is that when they first asked me to do the installation, I was thinking about climate change, and I was thinking about, you know, I realized that a lot of the pieces that I have been drawing over the years are sharing stories of communities that have suffered some kind of dislocation or devastation at the opposite end of the kind of capitalist machinery of our society, you know?
Right.
So, for example, there's the work that I'm doing in Braddock, which is around a community that lost its steel industry. So they were in the boom of the kind of production era, and then that industry moved on, and now there's this kind of slow-motion devastation that has happened whereby all the jobs are gone, the buildings are falling into ruin, and, you know, what happens to a community in that instance. And then I worked on a piece that was about there's a community or a group of communities, all of the indigenous folks along the Amazon and Xingu River basins in Brazil are fighting the construction of what looks like to be 20 dams on the Amazon River. And it's a horrific plan, and the Brazilian government dredged up the plans from the dictatorship in the 70s and started to execute them. It's this huge construction project, billions of dollars. But they did not get the permission of the indigenous people, and it's going to be intensely destructive, you know, ecologically and also just to their culture. And so people are fighting it really, really, really valiantly. And so I was able to visit this group of people and say, hey, do you want a portrait created? And would that be interesting to you guys? And they were like, yes, please. Like, all the ways that we can tell this story are helpful to us. And so I created that portrait. And there, I just was kind of looking at the body of work and saying, okay, so many of these stories are about the kind of loss of, like, hearth and home and motherland and thinking about, you know, the rafts and the Hurricane Sandy and what just happened to New York City and how much more aware we are of our own vulnerability. And then at the same time as I was working on this, because it took a while to plan, so my own mother got sick with cancer and passed away. And so it became this kind of deeply personal understanding of what it to lose your kind of first motherland, right? You know, your own mother. And and so I started to sort of think of these processes inseparably. And, you know, it's a little complex to explain, but my own mother had a lot of trauma in her life, and as a result, she dealt with a lot of mental illness and a lot of addiction and just had a lot of deep anguish. And that really expressed itself at the end of her life and her cancer and in her death. And I was thinking about traumatized people and traumatized cultures and how so much of the devastation that we have enacted on our environment and are enacting on our environment, it's a form of madness, and that we are sort of both traumatized and traumatizing ourselves and are traumatizing other cultures. You know, one of the other portraits that I created was a woman who I just connected with as an artist. She was an Australian Aboriginal painter, and I connected with her first as a painter. But then when I learned about her life story, you know, she was kidnapped at the age of 15 on horseback by white settlers in Australia and brought into this totally foreign way of life. And so, you know, I just realized that there were so many different strands of thinking about kind of our own relationship to the land and the ways in which disconnection has become a part of our lives. And so that was kind of the main theme, and that's how Submerged Motherlands became the title, sort of thinking about our homelands and thinking about flooding and climate change. And then because my own mother passed away, I created a portrait of her, and then, you know, I was thinking about kind of the trauma of her life and her own and kind of my own need for this connected, true kind of mothering, nurturing, kind of caring force, and how, you know, that's really at the heart of so much of our relationship to our home base and to our land base and stuff. And so I reconnected at that time with a friend of mine who was having a baby and who was just an incredible mother. And I just had this strong urge to draw her as the kind of mothering figure that would kind of mother all of us in that moment, you know. And so that was what that temple was about. The figure on top was this breastfeeding mother, and then the portraits on the sides were the portraits of my own mother in her process of dying. And then inside was this kind of contemplative light-filled space. But the light-filled space was also filled with honeycombs. And, you know, because such a linchpin of what's happening right now is the loss of the bees. And so, you know, it's one of those things where as I'm creating, it's never really a direct story.
No, not at all. There's that thread that just kind of, like, weaves itself in and out of all the different aspects and ties it all together.
Yes. Yeah, and there's, you know, the way that our minds think and process stories and think creatively and make meaning out of artworks and out of stories is sometimes a little bit less direct, you know, than like a news story or something. And mm-hmm. so sometimes the flow of the story is a little bit harder to explain. It's a little bit more disjointed or more intuitive, but it's all kind of in there in its layers.
Mm-hmm. But it's interesting when you said temple, you know, I didn't know that that's what you were creating, but that is absolutely what I felt. When I went inside the honeycombed object, I felt like I was entering a spiritual space.
Yes.
I felt that. And it was just, you know, and you felt like you were in the womb of that mother and child, you know? It was just beautiful. So it worked.
Yeah,
anyway. Let's take a couple minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the project that's going on in Brazil, because I was really fascinated when I was reading about that, and so many more of the things that you're doing. So everyone, I'm talking with Callie Curry, known as the street artist Swoon, and Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm talking today with Callie Curry. She is the street artist, also known as Swoon. And we're talking about how she weaves together her artwork with all the different passions and issues that are going on in our environment and globally. Are you with me, Callie?
I am.
Great. So the story of the train station in Brazil, about how they were clearing out all the homeless people, I was reading about that, and it reminded me of when Giuliani was doing the same thing right here in New York.
Right.
They, you know, all the homeless people disappear, you know, like over a course of a week, all of a sudden there were no more homeless people in Grand Central Station or Penn Station. I always wondered where they went, knowing that there weren't yep. not enough shelters for all those people.
Right, it was like, where did people go?
Right, where did they go? And so I think the same thing happened at that train station in Brazil, that and you were doing some work down there. Can you share that with us?
So that was a project. I was actually just thinking about this yesterday because I was working with this incredible organizer named, who actually I don't really she might not want to be named. Anyway, she's an incredible person, and she does beautiful land projects here in New York City, and she's just an absolutely fierce and beautiful activist. And so we kind of decided together to try to create a space that would host a lot of different threads. And so originally I had been thinking about what would it mean to try to create some shelters for people who were sort of in that transition on the plaza. And as I ended up working with her, it grew a lot into really looking at the deep, intense activist work that's happening in Brazil. And so we ended up partnering with kind of groups large and small all over São Paulo and creating this public space whereby people could kind of host events and get to know each other and work and cook and do classes and, you know, just all different kinds of things that could happen. Because we ended up being given this space, which was kind of the equivalent of like Rockefeller Center in New York. And
mm-hmm.
amazing that we were able to build this really grassroots.
Indoors, you know, the indoor space or the outdoor space?
So yeah, we built it out on this plaza. It existed for many months, and people used it in just so many different ways. Some people did end up occupying and living in different pieces of it, you know, and there were classes, and there were different kind of just activist events, and just tons of stuff happened. And actually, Occupy Wall Street ended up starting during the time that that was up, and so we ended up being able to lend a lot of our connections and resources to the occupiers who then set up in a different area of Brazil. But it was kind of a cool coincidence. But we ended up working with people who are doing really great urban farming work in Brazil. You know, the movement of people who are, you know, urban squatters, which in Brazil is connected to the land movement, the landless peasants movement in Brazil, which has been happening since the 70s, of people occupying unoccupied farmland. And yeah, so it was just really mind-blowing for me to see the scale of that organizing and to be able to create an artwork which functioned at first glance as a kind of a hive-like sculpture, but which at second glance housed all different kinds of ideas and projects and different people's needs in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm. And is that still going on?
No, it was temporary. It really only happened for about 3 months.
Yeah. You know, I have a very soft heart for the Occupy movement. You know, I had in my phone book the Occupy kitchen phone number, and anytime I had extra food, I'd, you know, go down there and bring food to people down there. And you know, I just loved the movement and what it stood for. And, you know, like you, you know, I just have, you know, so much anger or passion or love for the goodness of people and anger towards, you know, corporate America that has kind of like ruined it all and turned so many people into consumers that are just, you know, just the bottom line is it's just can't be the deciding factor, you know, on every step, every decision that our government makes. And unfortunately it is. And, you know, and that's one of the things that I just love about your work so much. And the Occupy movement, I think, really represented a lot of that for me, as it sounds like it did for you as well. Where do most of your ideas come from? I mean, I know also I was reading one of your interviews and they say a lot of times it's in a dream, you know, and then you combine it with reality. I think it's also, as you were saying, it starts with one idea and then kind of evolves as you're going.
Yeah.
Can you share some of that process with us?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it depends on what kind of project we're talking about. So I have almost like two different practices that flow in and out of each other's, you know, they kind of come together and diverge. And that's my independent studio practice, you know, kind of visual drawing and art making, and then my more community-based and public practice. And they definitely support each other and speak to each other. But I think that, you know, my very first kind of idea making is that really intuitive, a lot of stuff coming from dreams, a lot of stuff coming from just looking at a visual imagery of all kinds and kind of generating different kinds of images and experiences. Visually and aesthetically. And then the next sort of piece of my work is community-based projects like the work in Haiti or in Braddock or in New Orleans. And those are a little bit more directly in response to specific kind of communities and situations. Although now that I have been working in these specific communities for such a long time, it sort of has begun to feed back. So that, like I said, I realized that a lot of my drawings were containing the stories of different people's lives and struggles in different places and in different ways. And so much of that was from the communities that I was working directly with. And so there has become kind of a feedback loop where, you know, one way of thinking is feeding the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure that they would. Talking about feeding, have you done much work? I know you touched on, you know, the urban farmers that are, you know, occupying land that is not being occupied right now, and you know, and taking over and just creating farms in different places. But have you done much work with communities around food insecurity and you know, the issues around food that are plaguing our planet?
Yeah. I really haven't done much work with that at all. Some friends of mine and I used to do a dumpster to dinner all together, and that was one of those moments that was just kind of a fun thing that was about, you know, just like basically living off the waste of the city and creating a kind of a public and sort of a shared dinner space together. And I did that with a collaborator named Jeff Stark and a bunch of other people. But that's actually the only kind of direct food work I've ever done. And then, you know, some of the I work with farmers in Haiti, and they were a group of farmers who were beginning to kind of self-organize to try to get, you know, better prices for their stuff at market and just sort of, you know, just support themselves better. And so I sometimes work connected with farmers, but I've never done any food work myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I, you know, I guess I was thinking about, you know, when we think of the GMOs, and I talk about, you know, what GMOs have done, and then you have the super weeds that are happening, and then the super bugs that are happening, and, you know, you start thinking of Jurassic Park, you know, or I do anyway. You know, just, you know, what we are creating unknowingly by using all these chemicals, and how that is going to affect future generations, not even, you know, right now, the here and now, but just down the road. We're just playing with nature in a really, what feels like a really uncomfortable way for me. And, you know, I just love to see some artwork around that as well. Can you share with us some projects you're working on now?
Well, right this minute, I'm actually working on focusing on the work that I have already started. So I've decided I'm not taking on any new projects in 2015. And I've started a non-for-profit called the Heliotrope Foundation. And heliotrope is, speaking of food and plants, heliotrope refers to a plant's tendency to turn towards the sunlight. And thinking about, you know, our own tendency to do that as people who are trying to work for what we feel is the greater good, that we're always trying to sort of seek towards that light and seek towards how a situation can become better than it is. And so I'm just starting a non-for-profit to try to help the projects that I have started in Braddock, in Haiti, and in New Orleans be more sustainable, and so that I can basically be a better partner to the communities that I work with, so that I can really, you know, say, okay, we're going to do this thing over the next 10 years, and we feel really solid that this is happening. And so that's what I'm putting a lot of my energy into right now, is to just really starting to see through these projects that I've dug in quite deeply on. And so one of them is the rehabbing an abandoned Lutheran church and the adjacent lot in Braddock. And I'm also working with some farmers there. And right now we're trying to hand make all the ceramic tiles to fix the roof. And then we'll think about, you know, creating a kind of an arts focused community center and learning center, like really kind of deeply creative and playful learning center in that space. And then in Haiti, like I said, we're going to continue on with the possible sort of bamboo building and different styles of structure building with that community. And then in New Orleans, I'm working on a musical architecture project, which is very much just a joy and wonderment kind of project. It's, you know, I think that one of my most core beliefs is that if you can create really unlikely and kind of wonderful spaces and places, like you said, you had this kind of very spiritual feeling when you went into the structure in the Brooklyn Museum, that some sense of possibility in ourselves opens up when we inhabit spaces like that. And so in New Orleans, we're working on creating something which can really function as a incredibly joyful space that celebrates the music and architecture and, you know, just culture of New Orleans in general. So, yeah, working on bringing those projects into real fruition over the next couple of years.
And is there any way that community can help you? I mean, are there ways that people that are listening can get involved in any of your projects?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it depends on kind of where you are. Like in Haiti, we're tending to work really small, and so we don't bring, we're not tending to bring a lot of volunteers because our intention is to work really closely with the community that's there. But on each of them, I kind of invent little ways that people can become involved. Like, for example, on Braddock Tiles, which is the project of trying to refurbish this building and create it as a community space, I've made a little small print series and they're really like sold inexpensively on this website called BraddockTiles.org. And so, you know, people can go on and buy artwork, and that artwork becomes something that funds the production of the tiles to create this roof. And, you know, the idea is that this building will become something that once, you know, a lot of people who are in the neighborhood have worked on creating, there will be this intense sense of pride around it. And so, you know, even if you're not necessarily in the ceramic studio making the tiles with us or in Haiti, you know, laying the bricks with us, you still can kind of be involved with the little campaigns that help it come into fruition.
So, sure. Can you say that website again so people can write it down?
So there's two. There's one called heliotropefoundation.org, and that's the non-for-profit, the larger kind of piece that has just started. And then the smaller project with the prints that I mentioned is BraddockTiles.org, and that's BraddockTiles.org.
Great. Yeah, because I'm sure that there are people that would be very interested in doing that, and especially this time of year where, again, it's, you know, it's a time that you want to give, but you don't necessarily want to buy more things that you don't need. You know, artwork is always lovely. You can, you know, make your house more beautiful, and you can participate in, you know, one of these projects. So it has meaning, just like when you, you know, participate in any of the other nonprofits and you buy a goat for a farmer or, you know, some of these other lovely ways of supporting a child or, you know, other ways of giving that you're not directly just collecting more things that most of us don't really need. Okay, let's see. What else did I want to ask you about your artwork? Can you share your experience when you took those floating rafts to Venice?
Oh, yeah. That was incredible. So, you know, that was the fourth year, and so I had a big group of friends that were pretty good at navigating homemade boats. And so we had these three boats. If you can imagine, they're about 20 by 20 by 20 each squares, and they have these really insane motors, which were adapted from Mercedes motors, because we were originally trying to figure out how to run them off of grease. We didn't even get that far because there were so many challenges. So we had these really insane kind of homespun objects with crazy motors, and the driving systems were really nuts, and there was 30 of us that lived on them, and we were navigating them.
How many were there? Three?
Three rafts, yeah.
Uh-huh. And so like 10 people on each raft.
Yeah, we skirted the coast of the Adriatic Sea, so we would go out to sea for a few hours each day, but we would come back in the evening because they're not very hydrodynamic, these vessels. They really couldn't take a lot of heavy weather, and so, you know, one time we got caught in the Bora and we hit huge waves, and it was actually totally terrifying. But on the whole, it was just such an incredible feeling, you know, the feeling of being out to sea in something that you've built yourself, and you're driving, mm-hmm. you're driving it, or you're riding on the bow, and you're just going like, wow, this bit of the world is a little piece of the universe that we built with our own hands, and that's connecting directly with the Adriatic. And so, yeah, we just traveled along. Italians were so incredibly gracious and stoked, and people would bring us cases of wine and, like, huge trays of lobster lasagna and crazy shellfish and beautiful pasta and all different kinds of stuff. And we would do little performances just as a way to say, you know, people would say, what are you? And so we wanted a kind of connection point, and so we would create these kind of, you know, funny, beautiful performances that would use the boats as the kind of monstrous objects that they were. Mm-hmm. And then we got into Venice, and people, you know, the Venice Venetian authorities were terrified of us. They were like, what is this? What are you doing? You know, even the Biennale, we went during the time of the Biennale, although we weren't invited. And apparently the Biennale called our island host and said, like, these people are crazy punks and they're here to terrorize and destroy everything. And our hosts had already met us and they were like, no, they're fine. Like, don't worry. Uh-huh. But we ended up, you know, just going all through Venice, and it was such a magical experience to be in that direct of a discussion with a city that has built itself up out of the ocean in that kind of unlikely way. And we ended up going illegally into the Grand Canal overnight for like the whole night, which was beautiful because, you know, we got those boats look really crazy, but they're actually registered as legal vessels in the U.S. But the maritime laws in Venice are totally different because Venice is such an old city. And so we ended up having to just go illegally, and it was so beautiful and amazing. And no one ended up, you know, stopping us at all. it was just one of those things where I guess no one wanted to say yes and be the ones that allowed that to happen. But it was just totally enchanting for everyone who was on it and everyone who saw it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because Venice is one of those cities that will certainly be affected by climate change and rising seas. I mean, they're already, below sea level, I think.
Well, I mean, people don't use the first floor of their houses already. So,
right.
Absolutely, and like I said, sort of being in direct dialogue with our kind of more vulnerable cities, that was, going to Venice was definitely a piece of that.
Mm-hmm. And how'd you get them from the U.S. to Venice? You certainly didn't go across the Atlantic with them.
They just went in shipping containers. But actually, my mentor, the Floating Neutrinos, the people that taught us how to build our raft, they actually took a raft of pretty similar design across the Atlantic Ocean.
Really?
Totally crazy. It was basically a miracle that they survived. But they were just so wild and amazing and brilliant and out of their minds.
Uh-huh.
So they did that, and I think the boat, flipped over a couple times, but righted itself back up, and I think that they ran into a Russian barge in the middle of the ocean that drop-lifted them water and beats when they had run out of water in the middle of the ocean. And, you don't really run into other boats in the middle of the ocean very often, but
right.
they did right as they were running out of water. I mean, just totally crazy, miraculous stuff happens to them, so... We were not that brave or crazy, but the people that taught us and inspired us certainly were.
Yeah, well, when you observe all these, effects of climate change and just weather patterns and changes, I know as an adult I have such a different and a huge respect for the ocean.
Oh, yeah.
The power of the ocean, when you see, the tsunami coming over, into Indonesia. I mean, it's just the power of nature, because it's whatever the weather change is, they can all be so powerful and devastating and scary. And you have such respect. I know I have such respect for them, and my level of fearlessness has changed as I've gotten older. It's just amazing, but that it does sound pretty amazing what your friends did crossing the Atlantic, and miracles definitely happen all the time, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. So if people want to get in touch or go to your website, can you share that with everybody who's listening?
Well, actually, I don't have a great website of my personal work, so the thing that I would say that's good is if they have Instagram, my Instagram handle is SwoonHQ, and I post a different picture every day, and I also keep updates of all the projects that are going on. And also on Facebook, my page is Swoon Studio, and we also do a lot of updates. And then for the work in Haiti, the website is KONBITSHELTER.com, combishelter.com, or maybe that's org. I think we have both. And then, like I said, Braddock Tiles and Heliotrope Foundation. So all of those are really good places to see pieces of what I'm working on. And then the Instagram is a place to just get a little daily kind of update.
Uh-huh. And the area of Pennsylvania that you're in, is that anywhere near all the different fracking sites that are going on in Pennsylvania? Any of those people being affected by fracking?
Yes. Having some big, big, big fracking debates in Braddock, and actually the group that I work with is a group called Transformasium, an artist collective, and they have been really involved in trying to prevent the dangers of fracking in that community directly.
Yeah, because I just saw a documentary last week called Triple Divide, and it was almost all about Pennsylvania, but it's talking about the fracking, and earlier in the show I was talking about methane gas, coming from factory farms. Well, the second largest way that methane gas is getting released into the environment is through fracking.
Wow.
Wastes a lot of the water there too. So anyway, we are just about out of time. Callie, sorry, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. I just love your work, and I love that you are out there in the community creating change and working collaboratively with people on the ground and in your community. So thank you so much.
So much. I've had a great conversation with you. Have a great afternoon.
Great. You too. Bye, everyone, for now. Have a great rest of the week. Enjoy the holidays, and I will see you again next week. Bye for now.